Babb, whenever you're ready.
Excuse me. Thank you. Good morning. The respondent asked that you reverse the federal district court granting of habeas relief on the first issue before you, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim during sentencing. On the sentencing phase, the submission of the F7 mitigator claim, and ask that you affirm the federal district court order on the remaining two claims before you, the Brady claim and the mental retardation claim. Addressing the claim in which respondent is the appellant. The standard review by this court is de novo. As this court has noted, it's through the deferential lens of AEDPA. The underlying federal claim here is Strickland. Strickland itself is a deferential standard, but when combined with 2254D, as stated in Harrington, it's all the more difficult. Now, in Harrington, the U.S. Supreme Court stated habeas courts must guard against equating reasonableness under Strickland with unreasonableness under 2254D. That's the error that respondent submits happened in this case. The state court order on this claim held that it was without merit. The state court and post-conviction held the defendant failed to show the counsel was unreasonable. The state court held that there was no reasonable probability of a different result. The federal district court order came to a different conclusion, cited to the North Carolina Supreme Court cases of Holden and Zuniga, held that there was a reasonable probability of prevailing had the F7 mitigator been presented on appeal. The F7 mitigator is the age of defendant. Under North Carolina law, that's not strictly chronological age. So even though this defendant was well past 18, he could still argue based on intellectual capacity, mental age, and so forth. The federal district court held that this was unreasonable termination of facts and an unreasonable termination application of Strickland by the state court. This is the unreasonable termination of facts. There were no facts. There was no dispute about the facts. No facts were submitted on this in post-conviction. It was all on direct appeal. Therefore, the analysis, as this court held in Larry, it's really more of a 2254D1. It's not an unreasonable application of facts. And there is no dispute over the fact that the F7 mitigator was not raised or what the testimony was at the trial.
Now, Mr. Babb, the district court relies very strongly on the Holden case, and I don't see any mention of Spruill. Was there any discussion of Spruill in the proceedings in the district court?
No, ma'am. The two cases referred to exclusively, I believe, there are some cases about the background, but in terms of application of the North Carolina law on F7, it was extensively Holden and Zuniga. Now, Steen and Spruill are two cases that respondent argued more closely followed the facts in Richardson. Now, Spruill...
Well, the reason why I ask is those cases came out, 3 weeks apart.
Yes.
Holden was in the beginning of December, and Spruill was in the end of December. And
that's exactly right, December 9th and December 30th. Yes, Your Honor. And Spruill is much closer to the facts in this case.
They don't discuss each other either, right?
Well, they do. I believe, I'll have to look. I thought there was a reference, but no, they are two. They don't combine them. They are separate. Yes, ma'am. But the district court, when it applies Holden and Zuniga as the basis for it, comes to a conclusion that there's, and this is on the joint appendix on 1470, there's a reasonable probability petitioner would have prevailed on appeal, which is just a straight Strickland de novo application. There's a reference to AEDPA, but I would respectfully submit that's not really what was applied here. It was just a straight application of Strickland without going through the lens of AEDPA. Now, getting back to Holden is the main case, although Zuniga as well is relied on by the district court. I'm sorry.
Maybe if you can reconcile for me, maybe I'm just restating my colleague's question. Can you reconcile Spurl and Holden decided within months or weeks of each other?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Let me restate that.
Your position is they are consistent with each other, and so explain that to me.
The facts are different, is what I would say.
Not very.
No. Well, we
are. One man was 31 and the other was 30. We can start from there.
Yes. Yes. In Holden, there was testimony that that defendant had a mental age of 9 or 10 years. The defendant was mentally retarded.
In Spurl, he was immature, acting more like a child than others in his age group.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
That doesn't sound so different to me.
Well, okay, but let me attempt to answer that question.
There might be other differences. So you go ahead, right ahead.
Okay, thank you. In Holden, that defendant had difficulty reading materials for a 7-year-old. The IQ was argued to be 56. Now, there was different scores, but that was the IQ that was argued by that defendant. And that defendant, there was testimony that he had the problem-solving skills of a 10-year-old. Now, in Spruill, the IQ was higher. The reading level was higher, fifth grade.
Well, as I read the record in Holden, there were scores of 56 and 70. And in Spurl, there was an IQ score of 64, so it was right in the middle. Indeed, it's a good deal. I mean, the 70 in Holden was higher than the 64 in Spruill.
Yes.
One read at a 7-year level, and one read in fifth grade level. Does it make any difference to you whether they are distinguishable or not?
It matters to me to the extent that I believe that the facts in Spruill more closely track the facts in the case before you.
Well, what if we should hold they don't? Then do we affirm?
I don't believe, you'd have to hold more than that, I think, because this is AEDPA. I don't think you would want to just say Spruill isn't as close as Holden, therefore we're going to uphold the federal district court grant of habeas relief, because that wouldn't be an application of AEDPA, I don't believe.
Well, wasn't the analysis of the two cases totally different in terms of the standards? What I don't understand is why you're focusing totally on the differences in facts of those two cases, because isn't Spruill talking about whether there is counterbalancing evidence in the record, whereas Holden is talking about the evidence taken in the light most favorable to the defendant, whether it supports the granting of an instruction? So we really have two different, I mean, coming out of the court in that close period of time, two arguably very different legal standards. So how does that impact your case and your argument here?
Well, I was focusing on the facts more because I believe, like I said, the facts in this case track it. In terms of what Spruill adds about the counterbalancing evidence, I think that would support, I don't know if that would be inconsistent with Holden, because I think in Spruill there was evidence about employment and relations, and maybe that's why there was that addition. But why they don't more closely track each other in terms of the legal analysis.
I guess what I'm suggesting to you is it seems that you have an argument that the legal analysis in Spruill supports your position. And I am not hearing that from you, so you know maybe I'm incorrect on that.
Well, you're correct. You haven't heard it yet.
Okay.
But
make that argument? I haven't seen it either. So do you make that argument?
I made the argument that Spruill is more close to this case,
and on the
part
facts.
Of the reason, yes, and part of that reason, yes, ma'am, and part of that reason is in this case you also have testimony like you had in Spruill about. Richardson was married. He was a concerned parent. He maintained employment, various jobs, and there wasn't actually wasn't testimony relating to his emotional immaturity. Now there was testimony about him having an dependent personality, just like the defendant in Spruill. But there was testimony at Richardson's trial about his, I guess, for lack of a better, more adult-like behavior in terms of being a parent and having jobs. One of the things that's mentioned by petitioner is that the Steen case shouldn't be considered because it was after the decision by the Supreme Court and after Richardson's trial, and it wasn't cited to show reasonableness of counsel. It was cited to show how North Carolina Supreme Court has addressed these claims. Zuniga was also after Richardson. The two cases that were before, the two cases that we've been talking about, Holden and Zuniga, that were both in December of 94.
Excuse me. And, can I ask you, if you're gone with that, as I remember, the state court found that Richardson's ineffective assistance of appellate counsel argument was procedurally barred. That was error, correct?
I did not assert any procedural default defense.
No. that wasn't the question I asked you.
I'm sorry.
The state court found that Richardson's ineffective assistance of appellate counsel argument was barred.
Procedurally barred?
Yes.
Yes.
And that was error, correct?
That was incorrect.
Doesn't that make us wonder about state court's handling of this case? Does that cast doubt on what the state court did here?
No, ma'am.
Everybody's entitled to one error.
I don't know if I can put myself in Judge Sumner's mind, but we were talking. There was trial counsel. I mean, allegations of trial, and he should. I do not think it was correct to say it was procedurally barred. That is correct. I don't, because you can't procedurally bar the appellate counsel. I agree.
Right.
That was incorrect. But the factual determination, the conclusion that it was there was no possibility of a different result, I believe that still is entitled to AEDPA deference under Harrington and this court's.
No, to be sure. But how do we sort of put that in the mix, that we have an acknowledged error in the state court's reasoning by the state here before us?
I don't believe that would impact the deference that's granted to the state court decision.
Let me ask you a question before you run out of time. I want to go to the prejudice prong of Strickland.
Yes, sir.
In this particular case, the Marr judge ruled that there's no reasonable probability that in the absence of the error, alleged error, that the proceedings would have been any different.
Correct.
Which is a question of state law. So you've got a state judge looking at state law and predicting whether or not the proceedings would have been different.
Right.
Without the alleged error. Now, how do we factor that in when you take AEDPA and you take Strickland and you're evaluating this type of claim? How do we evaluate that finding, and by what standard?
I think that's part of the problem with the federal district court order, respectfully. The federal district court judge had to substitute his judgment on interpretation of state law, the application of the F7 mitigator. And while it may not fit exactly, and Estelle, it's not the province of federal habeas court to reexamine state court determinations and state law questions. This is purely a state law question. Now, granted, Strickland is the overlay. But the only way to get around the finding by the state post-conviction court that this defendant was not entitled to the F7 mitigating circumstance to be presented, and that was not error, would be to substitute the federal habeas court's judgment and say, no, I think there's a different and better interpretation of North Carolina law. And I think that's, I know Strickland is the overlay, but I think that's a problem.
Does that answer your question? Wouldn't matter if the state law, in your view, if the state law was not factually various in this case. In other words, some of these cases support you and some of them don't in a timely manner. If it was pretty clear that under state law he was entitled to this instruction, but the state court found it wouldn't prejudice him, in your view, we would still have to deny habeas relief. Is that correct? I'm just trying to understand the bounds of your argument.
Well, and I'll be honest, because it's Strickland, and when you say things like if the state court was unreasonable, I don't know if the bounds of argument.
I didn't say that.
Well, I thought that was hypothetical, Your Honor.
Okay.
But when we're talking about what you just said, some cases support me, some cases don't. That can't be error under AEDPA.
No, but I'm hypothesizing. I know that isn't this case. What
yes,
I'm
ma'am.
Trying to do is to figure out a rule for the next case. In the next case, the state law is perfectly clear that you're entitled to the instruction. So there was error, and the real question is whether that error was prejudicial. And if we have a finding, as we did in this case by the state court, that it wasn't prejudicial, it wouldn't have made any effect, do we still have to deny habeas relief?
I'm not trying to be difficult, just make sure I understand the hypothetical. In the hypothetical, it's where the state court law clearly states that he would be entitled to some
right.
mitigator, and it's unreasonable to assume otherwise.
No, I didn't say that. Oh. I said he was clearly entitled to it. That was an error of state law not to give it to him.
Beyond the possibility of any fair-minded disagreement.
Right.
Well, I think there that is different. Because
is it a difference that makes a result in our holding? Would we then have to grant habeas relief?
I'm hesitant to answer hypothetical questions, but yes, I mean, honestly, I would think that would be a difference that would affect the result, because if it's beyond any fair-minded disagreement, surely. But that's not here. Here you have cases that arguably can support defendants' petitioner's argument and support my argument under AEDPA, that can't grant in relief. And the only way to do so is to say, I'm going to apply Strickland de novo, which is what happened here,
okay.
and to substitute the federal district court's judgment for the interpretation of the F7 mitigator of this under state law.
Okay, I understand your argument.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've
Thank
got some time reserved.
Thank you.
Hammer.
May it please the court, my name is Stanley Hammer. I'm practicing Guilford County, North Carolina. I'm here with co-counsel Ken Rose on behalf of the defendant, petitioner, appellee, Timothy Richardson, who I would point out to the court, was found at the sentencing hearing. There was expert testimony that Mr. Richardson's overall functioning was comparable to that of an 11.5 to 12-year-old.
Mr. Hammer, can I ask you to, because I remember it, it's always unclear how long I'm going to remember something, to begin where your colleague ended and assume that North Carolina law was absolutely clear that you were entitled to the mitigator, your client was. Would we have to grant habeas relief then?
Yes.
Why wouldn't there still be a determination about whether that, in fact, was prejudicial?
Because we're looking at appellate counsel's performance, and we're looking at prejudice from the lens of not what a jury would find, but what an appellate court would find. And what we know is that the appellate courts have held uniformly, without question, if the F7 age mitigator is supported and should have been submitted, then, and it wasn't, then in that case, that's reversible error.
The appellate courts where?
In North Carolina.
Yeah, but when we get to federal habeas, isn't it perfectly clear that there are a ream of Supreme Court cases where there's clearly a Strickland violation, but the court refuses to give habeas relief because they find no prejudice?
Correct. Yes, of course there are, Your Honor, but my point is, in this case, because it's ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, and because you have the F7 jurisprudence, as I'll call it, in North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
it follows that if it were error to fail to argue that to the Supreme Court of North Carolina, then there's a reversal. Because in the cases, Holden and Zuniga are perfect examples. Those are cases in which the North Carolina court was so strong on this question, what they held was, even though in Holden trial counsel didn't want the F7 mitigator submitted, even though in Zuniga, in an earlier case, the F7 mitigator had been rejected by a jury. It has to be submitted if there's any evidence to support it, and the North Carolina court has never held anything other than that warrants a new sentencing
Spruill?
Hearing.
What about Spruill? How does that fit in? To me, that's just the mystery in this whole thing, because Spruill talks about, in deciding whether to grant the instruction, they say where evidence of, and I'm reading, I guess, let me see. I don't have the page number in front of me. I'm sorry. Page 33 of the printout. But in it, page 305. It says that where evidence of emotional immaturity is counterbalanced by a chronological age of 23 years, apparently normal physical and intellectual development experience, the trial court is not required to submit the mitigating circumstance of in age. So in Spruill, 3 weeks after Holden, the court saying you kind of weigh this, and if there's counterbalancing evidence, you don't have to do it. To me, that legal standard is really at odds, tremendously at odds with the standard in Holden, which I agree with you, seems to say that if the defendant presents the evidence, it's got to be in there. So how do we reconcile these, and how does the defendant get over the very strict standards we've got to apply today?
This is, I want to answer both questions. Mm-hmm. The first one, how do we reconcile it? We reconcile it, first of all, the Spruill and Holden decisions are reconciled this way. The court in both cases would recognize that age has to be submitted if there's substantial evidence. In Spruill, what they're saying, as I read it, is there's some evidence about IQ. There's absolutely no testimony, by the way, none from any expert testimony as to his mental age or his functioning age. But more importantly, or equally importantly, I should say, in Spruill, and you also see this in Steen, there are what the court refers to as counterbalancing factors. And those counterbalancing factors demonstrate normal intellectual functioning, normal functioning in society.
Well, the fact that he was an auto mechanic in a shipyard, he had moved on to a better position, he attended church and functioned quite well in the community. But in this case, you had a 10-year marriage, a loving relationship, an ability to hold a job. Why weren't those counterbalancing considerations within the meaning of Spruill?
They're not counterbalancing within the meaning of Spruill because in this case, you have the testimony, you have expert testimony, which states...
The court didn't say that in its legal standard. It wasn't looking to whether there was expert testimony. In Spruill, it was talking about counterbalancing factual evidence.
Well, it may be the quality of the counterbalancing factual evidence. The counterbalancing factual evidence in Spruill was testimony regarding his function and employment, which they seemed to focus on, which showed normal functioning. Here, there's no evidence regarding normal functioning and employment. In fact, the suggestion is that Mr. Richardson could not handle his finances. He didn't have long-standing jobs, and there was overwhelming evidence of immaturity and lack of social judgment and personality disorder. So what I say to you, Judge Keenan, respectfully, is that Spruill can be distinguished on several grounds. The next question, though, is how do I get over Harrington? And I would say in this case, no fair-minded jurist could find that given the testimony, expert testimony of Dr. Gorman and Dr. Royal, and the lack of any affirmative testimony, which you might have in Spruill and Steen about what a good worker this person is, or about how he advances or how he functions normally in the community, the court couldn't find that.
Well, here, though, Dr. Gross in Spruill, I promise this is my last question on Spruill, but Dr. Gross in Spruill testified that the defendant had an IQ of 64 and read at the 5.5 grade level, both being consistent, in the doctor's opinion, with mild mental retardation. So there was expert testimony.
There was expert testimony, but there was no expert testimony, if I may, Your Honor, respectfully say, regarding what age he functioned at. In this case, you have an expert's testimony saying that his overall functioning is of an 11.5 to 12-year-old. And if you look at the North Carolina cases, there's never been a case, to my knowledge, and I've looked at them, and I think the state would correct me on this if I were mistaken, but there's never been a case in North Carolina where an expert has testified, this guy's like an 11-year-old, this guy's like a 7-year-old, and the Supreme Court of North Carolina has said, well, that doesn't warrant submission. There are abundant cases, we've cited them in our brief, where the North Carolina courts say, Nicholson's a good example, where they say, well, the defendant met the threshold requirement for showing that the age mitigator should be submitted. A case where perhaps he showed that he was of a deficient mental age or his mental age was much different than his chronological age. So those cases are there.
I'm sorry you said that about Nicholson, but there must be a but because no relief is granted there. So but in Nicholson, he has a 12 to 13-year mental age.
The point about Nicholson, Your Honor, is in Nicholson, there wasn't really a question about whether it should have been submitted. It was submitted. He met the threshold requirement for it.
Let me ask you to discuss a matter that just makes me nervous in my limited amount of experience. In this situation, we're dealing with the construction of state law. We've got a state court judge who's more familiar with state law than we are, who has said the result of these proceedings would not have been different if this alleged error had not occurred. So it has me in the uncomfortable, or a position that's uncomfortable for me, for second-guessing a state court judge on a question of state law. So what deference, if any, do we owe the state court judge in a situation like this when we're talking about purely a question of state law?
Well, respectfully, Judge, I don't fully accept your premise.
Okay.
It's purely a question of state law.
Okay.
Because I think what you have here is the Strickland standard, which requires or dictates that the question of prejudice is a question of fact. Okay? So you have a mixed question of fact. And so the facts in this case are just what we've recited repeatedly today. What his intellectual functioning is, what his overall functioning is, that he has social judgment, naive orientation toward people, and dependent personality disorder.
Yeah, but that mostly, okay.
And then they take those facts, and then the question is, what would the Supreme Court of North Carolina do?
Right.
And we've cited cases from the Sixth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit. The Goff case is one in the brief, and we provided supplemental cases where those cases illustrate it's not solely a question of state law. It's a question of law and fact. It's not a question of what is the law here. It's a question of how do the facts apply. And that, I believe, is what Judge Boyle found was unreasonable, how the facts were applied in this case.
See, I think I had the same problem as the Chief Judge. A state need not have this kind of mitigator. Indeed, I've never seen one like this before. Be interpreting age to be mental age, right? So the United States Constitution doesn't require it. There's nothing in federal law that requires it. We're all in agreement on that, right? So we are supposed to give federal habeas relief on the basis of a state law right that a state court more familiar with state law has said is not applicable here. And that's where this seems a little different than most habeas cases. Is that?
That's exactly it.
And you're not granting habeas relief on a state law right. You're granting habeas.
Well, if this was in Maryland, you would have no right at all, I'm telling you right now. So it is a state law right,
but
this getting this mitigator.
Getting the mitigator may be a state law right.
Right.
Allocuting may be a state law right. Getting, as in the Goff case, there may be several different state law rights. But the question is, in a capital sentencing case, I might add, but the question is, What the right we're looking at is not the state law right, but the right to effective assistance of counsel.
Right, but you do understand that that North Carolina has chosen to put in that mix this right to a mitigator that I would dare say most other, and a mitigator based not just on chronological age, but on mental age as determined by some test or some expert. And I don't think most states have put that in the mix as a right that a defendant has. So at bottom, it is a right created by state law.
It's a right created by state law. I would just make two points in that regard. The first is it's a right created by state law, and effective counsel has the obligation to follow state law and bring the state law to the appellate court. And that's what we're talking about here is the Sixth Amendment claim.
Okay, so we're willing to presume you can establish deficient performance. But when you get to the prejudice and the determination as whether or not the proceedings result would have been different, we're trying to predict what state court would have done. Or looking at what state court would have done. And we've already got one state judge saying it would make no difference.
Well, you have one
state.
Where
are we?
Well, I would point out two things to you in response to that question. You have one state court judge saying that it would make no difference. It's the same state court judge who said the performance prong was met. And it's the same state court judge who I believe you questioned some of his other findings. That's the first point. The second point is it's not purely a question of state law. If it were, I'd have a harder argument, but it's not. It's not purely a question of state law. It's a question of prejudice under the Sixth Amendment. And in this case, I will meet the Harrington hurdle, Your Honor. I will go for a slam dunk or whatever you feel, however you want to characterize it. We meet it in this case. This Judge Boyle saw that we meet it. We meet it because it's so abundantly clear under state law that this would be a slam dunk winner.
So if we should conclude that it wasn't abundantly clear under state law, you lose, right? Yeah.
Not if you can find another way to rule for me.
Well, have you offered us another one?
Well, if you didn't find it was abundantly clear, and I would not concede that it's anything but absolutely clear, the other reason would simply be that if you're looking at prejudice, is there a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different? Well, there's a reasonable probability just based upon the questions that I've heard asked from the bench this morning regarding the application of Spruill or Holden.
Okay, and the difference in the outcome then would be what? A reversal in the appellate court?
Yes, the appellate court ordering a new sentencing hearing as they did in Holden, as they did in Zuniga. I see that my time is running out, so I had intended to argue Brady, but I will rest on our briefs other than to say simply this. This is a case, Your Honors, in which there were sheetrock tiles which were lost by the state. We had an expert come in and testify that, well, we really couldn't tell anything looking at those tiles. And then after the trial, we get pictures. We get a drawing of a circular pattern, which she didn't testify to, a circular pattern which a jury could find is like the circular pattern in the shoes of Mr. Hedgepath, which would corroborate my client's confession.
Okay, you've got some time reserved.
Thank you.
Mr. Bass.
What significance is the fact that the North Carolina Supreme Court denied cert on the MAR court's decision? Is there any significance to attach to that or not? is the granting of cert in North Carolina simply a matter of the court's discretion, or is the court obligated to review a case when it determines that there is error?
Matter of discretion, Your Honor.
Okay. So there's no significance then whatsoever. Okay.
I'd like to say otherwise, but no, ma'am. I want to address the F7 and respond a little bit to that issue. I disagree that this is anything close to a slam dunk. It's closer to I say Sproul is closer, but the cases you can argue, but it can't be a slam dunk. The problem, and I don't even like going so much in detail on Sproul because I'm not trying to argue you should find that it's like Sproul and that's the whole test. Of course, it's AEDPA, there's deference. None of that was done below, but I have to correct something. In Sproul, there was no testimony about mental age or functioning age. But in Sproul, you had an expert witness, Dr. Coleman, say he was immature, acting more like a child than others in his age group, and you had him reading at the 5.5 grade level. Now, yes, in the present case, at his trial, his defense expert said that his overall functioning was comparable to an 11.5 or 12-year-old, but that was, if you read it in context, in the joint appendix on 380 and 381, that was as a result of an intelligence scale test with a full-scale IQ of 73. And right after that sentence about functioning like an 11.5, 12-year-old, he had a lot of difficulty with anything based on language functioning. The testimony is just so close when you look at the facts in Sproul and Richardson, and that counterbalancing evidence is also present, Judge Keene, that you were referring to earlier. The IQs, the dependent personality, the intellectual reading level. In fact, he was at a fifth grade reading level as well in Richardson. It lines up so well.
The response, though, that we had here was that there was no evidence of employment functioning.
Well,
that you had in school.
That's going to be that.
How would you respond on that?
I believe we're going to have to agree to disagree with counsel on that because there was testimony by defendant's wife or mother of his children that he did work, and that was at the trial, and that's in her testimony, is included in the joint appendix.
He worked as an automobile mechanic and in a shipyard and moved on to a better position.
So, and he was a concerned parent. Before I run out of time, let me just conclude on my last position on that being that when the argument is a reasonable probability, that's just pure Strickland, and that's not the test before you on issue one. It is, as recognized in DeCastro and Harrington, application of both AEDPA and Strickland together, which is a far different matter. Briefly on the Brady issue, the most important point I want to make there is that this claim was decided on the merits. Now, the Federal District Court held that in an abundance of caution that it was going to review it de novo, but when you look at the MAR that was filed, the state court MAR, there was a Brady claim, and then there was an amendment, and it used the same numbering on the amendment to add to the Brady claim. The affidavit claim, it goes together. This claim was decided on the merits. The MAR was filed on the 18th of March, 1999, the amended MAR on 13 June, 2001, and then the order in April, 2002, denying the Brady claim. Restated in Harrington, when the federal claim presented in state court and state courts denied relief, it's presumed it was adjudicated on the merits. It was adjudicated on the merits and deserves that deference. Just to respond to the shoe print argument, both the agent at trial and defense expert witness, as cited by the federal district court, said it was insufficient for comparison to any shoe, the likeness of the print, and the evidence he could tell at trial, it did not match defendant's shoes. So that evidence was already before the jury.
Before you're seated, can I just
yes, ma'am.
be sure that I understand your argument. You've heard the various questions about how the fact that this is a right rooted in state law, this right to a mitigator instruction when your mental age is youthful as opposed to just your chronological age. And if it was clear on the facts of this case that he was entitled to this instruction, the state recognizes that he would be entitled to habeas relief. Is that correct? In other words, if there was a clear violation of North Carolina law, I recognize that you don't say there is a clear violation of North Carolina law, that you adamantly deny there's a clear violation, but if there were in another case, if there was that, would the person be entitled to habeas relief?
He would be entitled to relief under Strickland in post-conviction, but as you, Your Honor, pointed out in questioning, in habeas you still have that extra step of prejudice that you were referring to.
Yeah, but I thought you were up here before,
yes,
you said, but he would meet that burden.
Well, yes, and I said, well,
because North Carolina says if you're entitled to this instruction, you get it. I guess that would be your rationale.
If North Carolina said that.
Well, sir, I'm asking you what the state's position is. And I've posited to you, not this case, another case, where it's absolutely clear that the person was entitled to the mitigator instruction because of his mental age, and his lawyer did not ask for it.
And it was, Your Honor, when you state it like that, I can't help but assume that it's also absolutely clear that it was prejudicial to defend it.
Well, I thought that you told me that every time that you were entitled to it and you didn't get it, absolutely entitled to it, not a real question, but you were entitled to it,
mm-hmm,
that it was prejudicial under North Carolina law, and therefore you would get habeas relief.
I believe that is correct because if the way you're positing it, there's no other. I don't know how else to answer that question, to be honest with you. But that's not here.
No, I understand.
It's not even close to
here. I kept saying that.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I just want to make sure I'm not saying something in there.
Okay.
Is there any other questions from the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Babb. Mr. Hammer.
Your Honors, if I may address one matter that came up during the previous argument about the testimony of Mr. Richardson's wife. I do not believe she testified at the trial sentencing hearing. I believe her testimony was at the post-conviction hearing. And I think that's probably important, Judge Keenan, in response to your question about how Spruill plays in the good marriage. I just wanted to point that out. I don't need to argue it, but I think it's, in this case, obviously you have a record with both post-conviction and trial testimony, and I think in terms of the appellate ineffectiveness, we look at what the counsel had before him. Let me, if I may, just mention something about the Brady issue that's very concerning to me, to our position. Yes, it's true that there was testimony that the shoe print found did not match Richardson's shoe, so it excluded him. The problem is, what we don't have testimony to is that the shoe print, which I will show you, and it's in the record on page 1167, the shoe print, that is Mr. Hedgepath's shoes. Sorry, Mr. Hedgepath's shoe was on 1166. Look on 1166, and you see the circular pattern that was drawn. What the jury didn't have before it, and would have had before it, had we known of this, had the defense known of this, is that the pattern could be seen as similar to Mr. Hedgepath's shoe. The reason that's important is because Mr. Richardson has consistently maintained that Mr. Hedgepath was involved in this matter. And it becomes important, again, at sentencing, because it would really lead to an F5 mitigator, that is, whether defendant acted alone, And it would become important, as the court knows, because the jury would have to take, I mean, there's no question they would take into consideration that he didn't act alone.
If the jury accepts the fact that that shoe print was made during the commission of this crime, that's proof in there somebody else is there with him.
That's correct.
So, I mean, if you have a right to that mitigator, you've got it established just by the existence of another footprint.
It shows someone else is there with him, but
right.
This corroborates his confession as well. So, you know, the jury has before, okay, maybe he didn't act alone, he's guilty, but that could swing the balance, and this is a jury that had a question on question three. They were hung up on the question of whether aggravators outweigh the mitigators. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. I notice you and Mr. Rose are both court-appointed. We appreciate very much your undertaking representation of this client. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into the next case.